You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. With you. And what's going on in the news, which we will be getting into as we continue through the show. We'll talk about Benghazi. We'll talk about, you know, I've got a conspiracy theory around Benghazi that, well, I'll tell you about it a little later on. Maybe I'm nuts. I don't know. But I think that John Boehner and President Obama have got something going here that is going to work to their mutual benefit. But like I said, I could be crazy. So there's that. We passed the 400 parts per million carbon dioxide in our atmosphere over the weekend. And this is, we are now at carbon dioxide levels that precede, well, we actually have been for some time, but, you know, it's now like really in our face, 400 parts per million, that precede the emergence of humans. 3 million years ago was the last time the atmosphere had 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide. And at that time, it was Homo erectus, as I recall, or maybe Australopithecanthus, or however it's, I'll have to look at a human family tree. But we've only been around 165,000 years. We've never seen anything like this before. And we'll see where this goes. And to that, the Wall Street Journal published this fascinating little piece about CO2 is what plants crave. It was published by Harrison Schmidt, William Happer. What they didn't disclose is that neither of these guys have ever written any peer-reviewed research, that one of them is the Happer is the chairman of the George Marshall Institute, which gets money from Exxon and from the Koch brothers, and Schmidt is a director at the industry-funded Heartland Institute. Same thing. And Schmidt has said, by the way, the obvious path the United States under the current Congress and president is national socialism, the domestic repression and internal ambitions of the Third Reich. That's his thoughts on President Obama. And Happer, the other author, compared mainstream climate science to Holocaust propaganda. Apparently, the Holocaust was propaganda. Myron Abell is with us. He is the director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the conservative think tank. Myron, welcome back to the program. It's been quite some time since you've been on.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I read this Wall Street Journal op-ed even before I, you know, dug a little and discovered who these guys were who wrote it. Just in slack-jawed amazement. I mean, you know, plants do inhale carbon dioxide. We do drink water. If you drink, you know, like 5-6 gallons of water in a relatively short period of time, you will die. I mean, I don't even know where to begin with this.
Well, Tom, I think Jack Schmidt and Will Happer make two main points. One is that the carbon dioxide is not having the serious impacts that have been claimed for it. That is to say, the models predicting rapid rises in temperatures have not borne out. We have had...
You're talking about the 15- and 20-year-old models that...
No, I'm talking about all the models that are being run by the IPCC, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and the various universities connected.
Right, IPCC...
They all show significant warming, and we haven't had any warming now for about 15 years. So.
No, we're up 8/10 of a degree from the norm, and we're, if you're, and for, first of all, and just taking the last 15 years, secondly, and rather than, you know, decades or centuries in totality is rather odd. And third, the IPCC's original projection for warming, when we weren't hitting those early on in the 90s, and we didn't through the 90s and through the first couple of years of the 2000s, everybody's wondering where did all that, you know, what happened? And it turns out that the oceans have been absorbing that carbon dioxide like crazy. It's causing ocean acidification. It's causing the die-off of coral reefs and plants. And and the oceans are also absorbing a lot of that heat. So the Earth as an entire system, hang on, Tom.
The oceans can absorb more carbon dioxide if they're cooling. They absorb carbon dioxide when they cool, and they give it off. The oceans put it out into the atmosphere when they're warming. So under your theory, the oceans must be cooling.
No, that's not true. The oceans will absorb carbon dioxide relative to its concentration in the air.
No, Tom, I'm sorry. There's a lot of work done on the oceans and how much carbon dioxide and the rate that they can take it up. And it doesn't, the research that's done does not support your theory. It's not a theory, it's a scientific fact
that the oceans have been absorbing more carbon dioxide as we have been putting more of it into the atmosphere. This is simple osmosis. This is simple semi, the surface of the water is like a semi-permeable membrane,
Explain what the oceans were doing when there was 3,000 or 4,000 parts per million rather than 300 or 400 parts.
They had massively more carbon dioxide in them, of course, Myron.
The
carbon dioxide levels in the oceans are a reflection of the carbon dioxide levels in the air. All you have to do is go back and look at the science that's been done on the Permian extinction. You know, this is peer reviewed stuff published in 2003 by Wignall and I'm forgetting the other guy's name that showed that when carbon dioxide levels jacked the temperature of the surface up above 5 degrees, the ocean was absorbing that carbon dioxide and absorbing that heat, and to the point where it started melting methane crystals, which nuked the planet.
Right. Okay. Let me make my point again. The predicted very severe negative impacts of carbon dioxide have so far been hiding somewhere. And
it's called Hurricane Sandy.
Hide it in the oceans or hide it wherever you want. They've been hiding.
They're not hiding. They are hiding because Australia's on fire. The United States is on fire.
I thought you said we had to look at centuries, not a couple of years. Now you're talking about one event. It's been really cold in Minnesota and Omaha and Wyoming.
They're very concerned that the loss of sea ice up in the Arctic is causing changes in the northern hemisphere's weather patterns.
Now, look, if you think that we have to look at centuries, then I hope you won't resort to pointing one event. Now, let me get to the other point that Will Happer and Jack Schmidt make, and that is that the beneficial effects of higher carbon dioxide levels on the biosphere are very well attested in the scientific literature, going back hundreds of experiments, going back to the 1900s.
Myron, we have less than a minute. A real quick question for you. If you were about to walk across the street with a blindfold on and 97 out of 100 experts told you you would be hit by a car and killed, would you take the word of those three people and do it?
It depends on who the experts were. And unfortunately, the experts, those so-called 97 experts on your side, most of them are not very expert, and many of them are...
Don't you think if there's even as Dick Cheney said, we invaded Iraq based on a 1% probability that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. He said anything over 1%, we should, sacrifice the lives of thousands of Americans and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. Don't you think that at least if there's a 1% chance, we should be taking this seriously?
No, because I didn't agree with Dick Cheney. And I'm sorry that you did, Tom.
I didn't on the case of Iraq.
Well, then he's not a good example for your point, Tom.
Perhaps you're right. And we'll leave it at that. Myron Abell, the director of the Center for Energy and Environment of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org is their website. Thank you, Myron.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, global warming denial is alive and well at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, one of the largest conservative think tanks in the country. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I think it was 1990. There was one year, 1997, 1998. There was one year that was particularly cold. As I recall, it was it Mount Pinatubo? There was a volcanic event of some sort My recollection was 98 or 99. I was wondering why Myron was saying in the last 15 years we haven't seen much warming. Because we've, you know, it's been steadily going up since the 1950s, real substantially. And so if you'd had one particularly cold year as a result of a volcanic event, you know, throwing a lot of ash into the sky, reflecting the sunlight off, so it's called the albedo effect, reducing the temperature of the Earth. If you had one particularly cold year, if you went back to that, if you started counting from that cold year and then you took the warmer years since then, I mean, you know, 11 out of the 12 last years have been the hottest. Each one has been the hottest year in the history, as far as we can tell, of the human race. Certainly of the modern human race, the modern, you know, keeping track of temperatures. But I hadn't heard that, you know, oh, in the last 15 years before. And so I'm guessing that there's that we're dealing with some. But on the have you seen the ice creeping across the ground in Minnesota and Wisconsin, in Minnesota and some of the northern plain states? There's a video. The AP has a video out. They're over at Raw Story. You can see it. It's like, you know, this 2 foot or foot tall layer of ice just moving along at about a foot every a couple of feet a minute, or a couple of feet an hour rather, and sounding like a freight train moving across this yard in Minnesota. And it's because the Arctic ice is, you know, we've lost over 1 million square miles of Arctic ice from what's normally there this time of year. And as a result of that, you know, the instead of reflecting the sunlight back up and out, the ocean is absorbing that heat and staying warm, and that is creating high or low pressure systems up there that didn't used to exist that are pushing apparently the jet stream south and keeping the cold air farther south. And that's why, you know, we're just starting to have spring here in Washington, D.C. And normally it would be in the 80s or 90s here this time of year. I'm wearing a sweater today. I mean, it's 59 degrees outside right now. So it's not, I mean, yes, the planet itself is warming. We have 5% more moisture, more water vapor in the air, so the storms are more violent events, more precipitation. Where there's precipitation, more aridity, more dryness, more desert where there's desert. This the IPCC says the rising temperatures put 20 to 30% of plant and animal species at risk of extinction. I mean, that's no small thing. That's a very, very big deal. The World Bank said we're going to have severe crop yield reductions as a consequence of this. We're already seeing that last year. I mean, you know, not just last year, each of the last 11 of the last 12 years. Here's another way that the Wall Street Journal was incredibly disingenuous in this. And it's really quite mind-boggling. In their op-ed, they said current CO2 levels are low by the standards of geologic and plant evolutionary history. In other words, there was a time, in fact, they say, you know, that there was a time when carbon dioxide levels were 3,000 parts per million. Right now we're hitting 400. Yeah, that was the Paleogene period. That was 65 million years ago. And, you know, if you want to go back to that, I mean, that was 65 million years ago was when an asteroid hit the Earth, killed off the dinosaurs, apparently, you know, kicked up a lot of carbon dioxide. I don't know the exact mechanism by which this happened, but since humans came out of the trees or out of the seas or wherever we came out of, the seas is the hairless ape theory, for those of you interested. It's a fascinating hypothesis that the reason that we're the only primate that can give birth in water, standing in water. Women can give birth and the baby, you know, the placenta doesn't immediately disconnect. It's attached for five or 10 minutes after the birth, or can be. And so the baby can literally float underwater without breathing. As long as the placenta is still connected, the baby's getting oxygen through the umbilical cord. And we're the only mammal that can do that. And we're also the only mammal that has no hair on, you know, over most of our bodies. We're the hairless ape. And so why is that? Well, this is one hypothesis that at some point in human history, and keep in mind, human history is only 165,000 years old, that at some point there was probably some sort of catastrophic event and one that's been pointed to. I write about this in my book, The Edison Gene, actually. There's a chapter about this. Happened, as I recall, about 90 million years ago, when there may have been as few as 40,000 humans on the entire planet. And the only ones who survived, because the landmass, everybody was living in Africa, and the landmass was just basically on fire because of this atmospheric change. And the only people who survived were those who were literally standing in the water, in the ocean water, at the edge of the continental landmass for maybe a generation or two. It's called a bottleneck event, using Stephen Jay Gould's hypothesis of how evolution happens. And so all the rest of us, all of our aunts and uncles and cousins and brothers and sisters, they all died off. And just the hairless ones who could give birth underwater survived, who were probably mutants, you know, or variations. It's an interesting theory, the hairless. But in any case, we have, as a human race, never seen 400 parts per million carbon in our atmosphere, ever.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And where this is going to lead us is the subject of a lot of speculation, and most of it is pretty grim stuff. We need to take this seriously. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Jonathan in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on Minnesota's Progressive Voice, AM 950. Hey, Jonathan, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I was just calling in response to your guest, talking about the snow in Minnesota, because I've been dealing with that.
Uh-huh.
And looking forward to spring, and I'm like you, I'm wearing warm shirts right now. And when I look at it, I'm thinking, I took an astronomy class, and the Earth is getting to be as close to the sun in the northern hemisphere as it ever will, and yet we're still dealing with snow. So that would tell you that it's atmospheric. And you think that we are losing so much of the polar ice caps. And I told my daughter when we're looking at the snow in April and May, I said, well, at least now we know where the polar ice caps went.
Yeah. Well, literally, that's what happened. I mean, you know, there's 5% more water vapor in the atmosphere. Probably a fair amount of it came from the melting and evaporation of all that snow, all that polar ice. And it's coming down on you.
Yep. And I don't see once like we really run out of polar ice caps, I don't see the snowfall maintaining.
Yeah.
I say like, well, once we get to the point where we're like facing record heat and droughts and stuff, then what is the other side going to say? Oh, I guess you were right.
Well, what they're doing, basically what the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil and the groups who fund these think tanks are doing is they're saying, you know, we've got several $1 trillion worth of oil, gas, and coal on our books as assets. And we will spend millions or even tens or hundreds of millions of dollars to be able to extract as much of those trillions of dollars worth of oil, coal, and gas as we possibly can, before it becomes obvious that we can't do it anymore. And so they know that they are the buggy whip industry. They know that they are, you know, phased for extinction. But at the same time, they also, and I suppose there's probably still one or two buggy whip makers in the world. I mean, we'll always use a little bit of oil or coal in various ways as raw materials for things. But this is all about getting as many dollars as possible, as fast as possible, and damn the consequences. And they're putting your children and mine, and you know, if I had grandchildren, I wish. One of these days, and everybody else is at tremendous risk. It is mind-boggling. Jonathan, thank you for the call, and thanks for your kind comments. Robert in Denver. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Tom.
So CO2 and chemistry?
Yeah, you know, hey, I love your show. Thank you for everything you do.
Sure.
A voice of reason is really appreciated. So, yeah, your guest, I don't know, seems really sophomoric to me. I didn't go to college. I've been reading an old textbook of my wife's,
mm-hmm.
General Chemistry, right? 1982.
Mm-hmm.
Carbon dioxide will continue to dissolve into the ocean until it reaches saturation, if I understand things correctly.
Right. Yeah, and
okay,
there's...
Right?
Yeah.
So,
well,
I was just appalled at the level of intelligence that he displayed.
Yeah. I think he's asserting that the oceans are at saturation, and I don't think that that's the case. I really don't. And,
oh, well, I hope not.
Yeah.
If it was, that would just mean we're in much worse shape than we're in.
Right.
Than we currently think, right?
Right. And carbon dioxide also can... you know, combine with and mix with other things and form other forms of, but principally it's carbon dioxide. It's turning the oceans acidic. You know, it's the more there is in the atmosphere, the more there will be in the oceans. This is, I believe it's kind of chemistry 101. Robert, thank you for the call. Just speaking of, school teachers, Charles, you're a former school teacher.
Yes. I'm a recovering school teacher, Tom.
Okay.
I'm driving a truck.
Okay. And
one of the things that he just said is correct. It diffuses into the ocean until it reaches saturation. But as the ocean's warm, it gives off the oxygen that it absorbs quicker than it does the carbon dioxide.
Okay.
The only time that water warms and that it gives away carbon dioxide is when it's under high pressure, such as when you have a soda or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And as the soda warm, it gets rid of the carbon dioxide.
Right,
but
the bubbles come out.
Because it's supersaturated at that point.
Right.
The other thing he forgot to mention was yes, we're a little cooler here this year, but Australia's carrying record heat along with southern parts of Africa and South America.
Right.
And, of course, as the carbon dioxide absorbs into water, it will mix with the water and form a compound called carbonic acid, which is why the oceans get more acidic as they absorb more carbon dioxide.
Thank you for that. I was grasping in my mind for the compound that the carbon dioxide would convert into that would, you know, even if we're at saturation, it as it converts into carbonic acid, that allows the ocean to absorb more carbon dioxide, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And also the other thing is it's not osmosis. That has to have an actual working membrane.
Right. And
it's called diffusion.
Yeah. Okay. So it's called diffusion where it goes across the surface tension.
Of the water.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a long time since I took science. So diffusion, not osmosis. Got it. Charles, thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. It's great to have teachers listening to the show. Jesse in Vashon, Washington. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for your show and your work with such books as The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. I consider you a hero on this topic. I wanted to bring attention to the work of Professor Mark Jacobson out of Stanford. He has done studies I would consider the most comprehensive and detailed on plans to convert all global energy demand to what he calls wind, water, and sun. And he also he's a professor of atmospheric or the Department of Atmospheric Studies at Stanford. And one of the things that he brings out is that there are 2.5 to 3 million air pollution deaths per year, and that these equate to about 3% of the GDP if you want to break it down to numbers. And so besides the global warming arguments that he also addresses, just the particulate matter and air pollution,
right.
And he really lays it out. There's enough raw materials for all of this. It doesn't cause that much space. The costs are there. The intermittency that is often laid on renewables is making them unfeasible is not a problem. They've already done the studies showing that we can match the demand load with a widely geographically dispersed array of solar, wind, and hydro.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And my understanding, I don't know if it came from Mark Jacobson or not, but the study in which I saw that 3% of world GDP being the consequence of pollution, a 3% loss, also said that in the third world countries and developing countries is 11%, that they're disproportionately being harmed relative to the first world countries that maintain a relatively clean environment. Is that consistent?
With coal in their house and all sorts of things, yeah.
Right, yeah, okay, great. Thank you very much for that, Jesse. Appreciate the call, and there we go. Steve, listening on Sirius in Haymarket, Virginia. You know one of the articles of this Wall Street Journal article?
Yeah, Harrison Schmidt is was the last moon mission. He's a PhD in geology, and he's been studying on this for very many few years. I know he doesn't have any pure research, but he was a United States senator. He's been, like, busy.
Yeah.
And so at any rate, the point is, I also know Richard.
Well, he's also a director he's a director at the member of the board of directors of the Heartland Institute, or was as of 2010. He's still listed as a Heartland expert. ExxonMobil contributed over $600,000 to Heartland between 1998 and 2006. Heartland used a billboard featuring Ted Kaczynski to launch its campaign comparing those who accept climate science with murder, tyrants, and madmen.
I don't understand why that has anything to do with science.
I don't either, but if you're talking about Mr. Schmidt, he was the director at the director at the Heartland Institute when that happened.
Okay.
So.
And I'm a member of that organization.
You are? Okay.
Yeah, and it's... there are 32,000 scientists, 9,000 of whom were PhDs. On the other hand, you've got like James Hansen, who's an astronomer. He's not a climate scientist.
So you're trying to argue that the Heartland Institute is the mainstream and that the IPCC is the fringe?
Yes, absolutely. The IPCC is doing this. There's only 28 actual scientists that I can count. And I've been looking at it since 76, who are on this.
Think maybe you should walk outside, you know, get out of the, you know, you've got to be, if you can't find this, Steve, another planet maybe? I mean, where have you been?
Well, in other words, yeah, actually, I've been in the Washington D.C. area for like 30 years now.
So you know, you're ignoring the vast majority. You're ignoring all this peer-reviewed science that is being produced by institutions all over the world.
No, I'm actually reading it and discerning it. And the hottest temperatures were in the 1930s. It was during the Dust Bowl.
We're hotter again, and there was and by the way, that was not the hottest worldwide temperatures. That was the hottest temperatures in the United States, and that was the result of lousy agricultural practices that killed lots and lots of trees.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
There's a great documentary on that. And by the way, the guy who fixed that problem was Franklin Roosevelt. He said, let's plant those trees with a civilian conservation corps. Put people back to work. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Tim, listening on TuneIn Radio in Falls Church, Virginia. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hi. You mentioned Mount Pinatubo. We're still on the climate issue. I believe it happened in 91 or 92. I vaguely remember it because of the nice sunsets that we saw.
Yeah. Well, that wouldn't have been within the 15-year window. So maybe it was the Icelandic eruption that I'm remembering, or who knows? I don't know. I'm assuming the Myron's not just making up numbers, that he's very carefully selecting how many years he's going to measure.
Right, right. I remember the summer. One of the papers wrote what happened this summer. We were like stuck in the perpetual lower to mid 80s, it was drier, which is another topic I like to get into. It was cooler and drier because of all the particulates in the air.
Right.
And we didn't have that much rainfall. We didn't have those downpours, thunderstorms. Have you heard of the phenomenon global dimming?
Yeah, it's what I refer to as the albedo effect. It's where you've got a lot of particulate matter in the atmosphere, or even actually exhaust from jet engines, and
right.
and you know, the contrails, the so-called, and
yeah.
they reflect the sun at high levels of the atmosphere. They reflect the sun's energy back out before it has an opportunity to get down into the troposphere.
And certain certain latitudes are in a prolonged drought because it interferes with the evaporative cycle. In other words,
mm-hmm.
I mean, why Australia is such a mess? Africa, the Sudan, the Southern Plains, and so forth.
Yeah. One of the things I thought was really interesting is right after 9/11, when we declared basically all air traffic across North America stopped. It was the only time in my recollection, in my life, when I could look up and see nothing but blue sky, And apparently they were able to measure a small but measurable change in the absorption of heat as a result, increased absorption of heat from the sun as a result of there not being any exhaust from jet engines. And they came to the conclusion that if all the jet traffic were to stop tomorrow, then global warming would be going even faster than it is right now.
Right. It would get hotter, but maybe if we lit through it, it would be balanced. In other words,
who knows? That's assuming that we, hadn't hit 400
right.
parts per million. I mean, we were at 280 parts per million for, pre-industrial. When
right.
this country was founded, we were at 280 parts per million. We're now at 400. The human race has never seen this in our history. And
it's spooky.
Yeah, it really genuinely is. Thanks a lot for the call, Tim. I appreciate it. Gabriella in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Gabriella.
Hello. Hi, Tom. I'd like to share a little science, if I may.
Okay.
I think an earlier caller talked about us getting closer to the sun as we...
Yeah, and I think really what he meant was in the North American hemisphere, we're tilting toward the sun.
Right. Yeah. I just wanted to clear that up, that actually we're further away from the sun.
Yeah, in the summer.
And
yeah.
as we reach the solstice, we'll be furthest away in our orbit from the sun.
That's right. And in the winter,
really
we get closer.
The tilt of our Earth, not the distance that makes the
right.
big
and,
difference.
And
in
the winter, we get closer, and that's...
Winter.
Yeah, and that's why the southern hemisphere's weather is so different from the northern hemisphere.
Yes, and ocean acidification, that is a major issue right now.
Yep.
With the carbonic acid, it creates an environment where the mollusks and corals cannot produce shells anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it would actually dissolve their shells, but that is a major, probably larger than the temperature change with the ocean
yeah.
acidification.
And they're looking at the eggs of a variety of species. There was one starfish that is on the edge of going extinct in a lot of places because the carbonic acid is dissolving the eggs before the eggs can mature and hatch. But it's the real thing that we have to worry about is the very, very bottom of the food chain, the zooplankton, the krill. These little tiny, almost microscopic things that whales eat by the ton, and other fish and whatnot eat, and many of them have exoskeletons. Even though they're microscopic, they're like basically little tiny shrimps, only a hundredth of an inch long, and those exoskeletons, those external skeletons, are made out of calcium that will dissolve in the presence of carbonic acid. And
they are. They found up in the Arctic that they're actually dissolving. The
yeah.
first time it's ever been documented.
Wow.
So this is scary business.
Yeah, it is. It is. We need to spook the herd. We need to wake people up in America and around the world. It's actually Europe is well spooked already because they got this story a couple of decades ago, and they figured out that if the Gulf Stream stopped, Europe would be thrown into an ice age, and then they made that movie the day the Earth stood still, based on that science, which was projective science, but it was pretty solid science. But now, I mean, we're so much farther beyond. Gabriella, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to Sirius up there in Vermont. Walter in Leesburg, Virginia. Walter, we got a minute
Hello.
To the end of this
hey,
hour. It's yours.
Hey Tom, what I call these people, the ones that want to be these naysayers.
Mm-hmm.
You ever watch the movie Superman, when Superman's father went to the Council of Elders and told them the planet was going to blow up? and they told him to get lost. We're going to throw you in prison. And what happened to Krypton? Blew up. It's exactly what I'm saying. That's the analogy I'm making.
Yeah.
These people want to deny, deny, deny. But I guarantee when stuff really starts hitting, you know what? Those would be the first people to squawk.
Yeah.
Saying, why didn't you tell us? We have. We have been telling you that.
Yeah.
Telling you this all along.
I you know, I'm with you, Walter. I'm not sure that they'll be the first to squawk. I'm guessing that what they will be doing is buying large swaths of northern Canada property that will soon have the climate of Michigan, and you know, building fortresses and armies, and Blackwater will have a reincarnation as a private security force, and God only knows. But even that, I mean. Well, who knows? Walter, thank you for the call. Who knows where this is going? And you try to get inside the brain of some of these people, you know, the head of ExxonMobil or the Koch brothers. You know, why would they do this? It's unfathomable to me.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Skip Coriel is on the line with us. He's also available on Skype. Skip Coriel, CoryEll.com, right? SkipCoriel.com?
That's correct.
Okay, you are a pro-Second Amendment activist, the author, and author. Your latest book is called The Shadow Militia and the President of White Feather Press, LLC. Just a couple of, in the last 5 months, we've had 71 kids now killed by guns. This is, you know, since Newtown, average age 6 years old, kids killing kids by accident mostly. Meanwhile, Missouri has passed a bill, and Texas. Actually, I think we're up to now three states that have basically said federal laws don't stand, federal gun laws don't stand in our state, which is, as I recall, something, not this specific issue, but, you know, it was around the issue of slavery. But the southern states were talking about this in 1850, well, starting in the 1830s, actually, with the very, very aggressive activities of President John Quincy Adams, who then, after he left the presidency, ran for the House of Representatives just so he could take on the slavery issue. And, you know, this growing movement to criminalize or end slavery at a federal level, the southern states saying, no, we're not going to do that, you know, anticipating an emancipation proclamation. And so in 1860, one of those states left around the time of the Lincoln election. And then by March of 1861, when Lincoln was sworn in, another five or six states had left the Union. Do you have any sense that that's the direction that we're going here?
I think it's the direction that we're headed. It's by no means inevitable. I certainly don't want that to happen. And we need to come to some kind of a step back from the edge of the cliff here and just think about this before we keep going the way we're going. I mean, certainly the people on my side, you know, all the other pro-Second Amendment activists, they're all fired up about it and very emotional. And probably the people on your side of the aisle as well, in the opposite. But
I'm not opposed to guns. I'm a sports shooter myself. And to the best of my knowledge, the only piece of legislation that the Obama administration has put forward is to close the gun show loophole, and that increased the penalty to anyone who tries to create a federal registry from 5 years, which is what it is right now, 5 years in prison if you try to create a federal registry, to 15 years. I don't understand where this hysteria is coming from. I mean, I saw Wayne LaPetite LaPierre on TV, testifying before Congress, you know, but in his private speeches, I mean, there's all this, you know, hysteria. Rand Paul has got a fundraiser out saying that Obama, you know, wants to sign the Small Arms Treaty with the UN, and therefore they're going to come take your gun. I'm sorry, the Small Arms Treaty only regulates the traffic in small arms, specifically AK-47s, between countries. They're trying to get a hold, they're trying to get a handle on where, you know, all these deadly weapons that are going mostly into places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where you've got this civil war going on, or south of North Sudan. And that seems to me like a reasonable thing. It's not going to affect you or me. Am I missing something? I mean, I'm seeing a lot of light. I'm not feeling a lot of heat. I mean, it seems like there's, you know, a lot of people yelling and screaming here, but there's no there.
Well, I think what you're missing is you don't really have a good window into the kind of people who are in the Second Amendment movement. You know, the really charged up people. You know, you're talking about southern states, western states. They take it very seriously, and they have a very, very healthy distrust for the federal government.
But Obama has expanded gun rights. He said you can take a gun into a national park now. He said you can take a gun on Amtrak now. I mean, he's actually expanded the number of places where you can carry a gun, not contracted it.
Well, no, but he also has tried to restrict. I mean, he was in full support of the Dianne Feinstein assault weapons ban.
He did
ban.
Not support that.
Yes, he did. He certainly did support that. He wanted that to pass.
Let's say he did. You know, Ronald Reagan supported that. It was law of the land for 10 years.
Ronald Reagan was not a perfect man. I do not support an assault weapons ban. I believe in the slippery slope. You start naming guns and putting them on a list and say these are banned, these are not, mostly because some cosmetic feature that they have, and you're just going to add to that list.
Do you think we should unban fully automatic weapons?
No, I think we should unban them. They've been banned since the 1930s.
Right. Right, but it's, I mean, you know, there's that slippery slope. Should we reverse that? Should we say, okay, it's all right, a shoulder-fired surface-to-air missile? I mean, that's arguably a single-person arm.
Tom, you're being absurd. You're being ridiculous. You're taking a far, far lunatic.
No, I'm saying, where do we draw the line? It seems to me that we should draw the line at weapons of war.
No, why don't we draw the line with the Ten Commandments? Thou shalt not murder. You said 71 kids were murdered by guns. They weren't murdered by guns. They were murdered by people, not by guns.
I didn't use the word murder. These were 71 kids who were killed by other kids in accidents.
And most of them were gangbangers, Tom.
No, actually, most of them were, the majority of these kids who are killed by these guns are not gangbangers. They are white kids, white rural kids.
They're way wrong. You're off base.
No, I'm serious. Go back and look at the statistics. Look at the names. Look at the pictures. There's no secret here. I mean, this stuff, every day there's a new one and most of them are suburban white kids or rural white kids.
Tom, I listened to you do the news right before I came on. That was the most biased, hate-filled news segment that I've ever heard.
We can discuss my newscast, you know, if you want. But I thought we were talking about guns here.
I mean, just be civil about it. I said when I started out, I said we should step back and put some sanity into this.
I agree.
The brain.
So how do we do that?
Well, for one thing, we have to stop talking about more gun control laws. Or what we need to be talking about is something that we can agree on, like the mental health issue. I mean, all these, you know, Sandy Hook, all of the shootings that we're having, I mean, guns aren't jumping up and running around killing people. They're being wielded by crazy people. We have a terrible problem in our mental health system.
Okay, so why then would 40-some-odd senators vote against a piece of legislation that says that if you buy a gun at a gun show, before you buy that gun, somebody's got to make sure that you don't have a history of violent mental health issues?
I think it's because they're afraid of their constituents. And like you said earlier, there's a lot of people out there who are panicking, and they're running scared. And so these.
But I think they're being panicked by people who are trying to profit from it.
That's possible, but I think they're also being panicked by politicians as well.
Who?
You know, the White House, when he issued those 23 executive orders, that panicked people when the Department of Homeland Security, you know, bought up the option for 1.6 billion rounds of.
It turns out that was absolutely routine. I mean, even the Republicans, when James Inhofe brought that up on the Senate floor, he's now walked that back. He's like, yeah, okay, you know, this is just the government. You know, they do this every year. They buy in bulk to get a better price.
Well, they never bought this much. People are scared. People are.
Well, we've never had this many federal officers. All these guys who are working in the airports, that all used to be private security. Okay, Skip, we've got to wrap it up, and your audio is starting to break up, so my apologies for that. Skip Coryell, SKIPCORYELL.com is website. Hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Skip is a pro-Second Amendment activist and author. His latest book is The Shadow Militia. Thanks, Skip, for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. You have a good day.
You too. We'll be back. Tina makes a really interesting point that during Hurricane Katrina, George W. Bush sent the militia in, the military in, and they went door-to-door and confiscated people's guns. And where were these guys freaking out then? And while I, you know, doubt and would not attribute to Skip, you know, racist motives, seems like a decent guy, and his whole thing was we need to step back and calm down the rhetoric. God bless him for saying that. I think that some of the folks who are stoking the fervor here, feeding the flames, you know, the Rand Paul fundraising letter, you know, that the president is going to join with the UN. Well, that's all those other countries where there's people who are just, you know, many of them not Caucasians. This African-American president is going to hook up with the UN that's, you know, the majority of the world is not white. It's true. And he's going to hook up with them and ban small arms, or at least the trade in them between countries. So we can't have that. Well, I don't think Rand Paul actually explains that the small arms treaty has to do with weapons between countries. I think most Americans, if you said, you know, the UN would like to pass a law that makes it harder for warlords in Uganda or the Democratic Republic of Congo or Burma or, I mean, you fill in the blank, right? North Korea, to get weapons. I think most Americans would say, it's fine with me. You want to stop the mafia in, you know, fill in the blank, whether it's Italy or Kazakhstan, from selling weapons to people in Congo? But Rand Paul has turned this into a fundraiser. It's really quite remarkable. Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind?
Yeah, interesting conversation.
Indeed.
You're right. You know, people need to step back. Nobody's really, you know, gun rights are gun rights.
Yeah, Skip, you need to take it off. You need to take it off speakerphone. You just.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
There you go.
All I'm saying is half these crackpots that call you, and they are crackpots, don't got a clue.
I don't think.
No, I mean,
they're crackpots.
If they want a clue, why don't they go spend 18 months overseas? Then they'll step back. You know, like I heard you talk about machine guns. Yeah, Kentucky's got the, I think that's class 3.
Mm-hmm.
And it's stupid. You know, I mean, I've read two books here recently, and I'm sure you probably read them too. The Big Con, Crackpot Economics, and the Fleecing of American by Jonathan Chait.
Yeah.
And how about this one? You Are Being Lied To, Disinformation Guide to Media Distortion. You know, I never knew Wayne LaPierre has been like a pain in somebody's side since 1974.
Yeah.
And it's always the people. I ain't never served or been in a force, police force what, and they're the first ones. Yeah. You know, it's ridiculous. And, yes, we are supposed to be the greatest, most peaceful country in the world, But what is our main business? We got more nuclear weapons. We sell more guns. Some, you know, our forefathers, I don't think they'd appreciate it.
Yeah.
I'm not so paranoid that, do I need to keep a machine gun on my kitchen table for the armed invaders? Give me a break. Man, these people need to grow up. You know, this is American way. If you don't like what's going on, you vote. And I'm personally getting awful tired of people bashing Obama because he's doing the best he can in a sticky situation. And you're right, racism is a problem in this country. But, you know, my son, his wife, the younger generation, 30-something, I'm old, you know, they don't even work a sweat up. You know, my son spent 11 years over there.
Over where?
Iraq, Afghanistan.
Yeah, wow.
You know, continuous combat. This country's been fighting wars for the last 50 years, and something's got to happen. Something's going to stop. You know, and I've lived in Baltimore. I've lived in Atlanta. I lived in New Orleans. I spent a little bit of time out west. Hunting is, you know, like American thing, but all this, I mean, it's like paranoia. And as far as Tim McVeigh, you know, when he got out of service, he couldn't find a job, and he was frustrated, you know, and...
Yeah, well, that was another point that I wanted to make to Skip, which was that violence goes up as inequality goes up, and as our society has become more unequal, the rich have gotten richer, the poor have gotten poorer. We shouldn't be surprised to see a rise in violence, although actually murder is down over the last decade and violent crimes in general are down over the last decade. And that seems to tie back to the fact that we took lead out of gasoline a generation ago. And, you know, but in any case, it's, yeah, point made, Rick. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Paul, listening on KBCS in Woodinville, Washington. Paul, we got a minute to the break. It's all yours.
Yeah, Tom, you were talking about global climate change before, and I wanted to mention that if you take CO2 out of the equation, the generation of heat is enough. I mean, if you drive to the down to the store and back, don't put your hand on the engine block of your car.
Right.
But when you come out an hour later, you could. But the heat didn't just disappear.
You're right.
It dissipated and absorbed into everything around it.
Right, and all the power plants.
The lighting still...
Yeah, and then there's a reason why we put all our power plants on rivers, and that's because we need to use the water to cool them.
Yeah, and we have enough heat in the environment, and it comes from the sun. I mean, people say, oh, global climate change, it's the sun. Well, yeah, it is. It's kind of like this turning on the lights from the sun from millions of years ago.
Right.
So, like, when you walk into a lighting store, it's warm in there, you know?
Yeah.
It's not because of excess CO2, it's because all the lights are on.
Right.
The planet can only dissipate heat because it's an object. It can only dissipate heat so fast.
Right. It stays in the atmosphere. You're right, Paul. Thank you for the call. And it is sunlight from hundreds of millions of years ago, which is why the book that I wrote about the topic, I titled The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm surprised that more people are not calling out Rand Paul in the national media for his fundraising stuff. I mean, it just astounds me. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Doug wants to set the record straight. George Bush did not authorize the confiscation of guns in New Orleans, you are saying. Do I have that right?
Yeah, don't you know that?
No,
New Orleans Police Superintendent Eddie Compass did that, in order to the local police, the U.S. Army National Guard, and the Deputy U.S. Marshals, not George W. Bush.
Okay, but who does
if
the
I'm
U.S.
I'm not mistaken, that who? Was a Democrat-controlled mayor, right?
Okay, so why did George Bush not stop that?
Wait. You said that George Bush sent an order. So
and you've corrected me. And I appreciate that, Doug. Thank you. But okay. You said that the mayor, this Democrat mayor, asked the U.S. Army National Guard.
Gave an order.
Ordered them to confiscate guns. That National Guard reports to President Bush. Why did he not stop that?
Well, I don't know. I'm just.
Okay. So it was okay with George Bush when guns were being confiscated,
no.
even though he didn't order.
Don't pull words in my mouth, Mr. Herman.
Okay. So it wasn't okay with George Bush when guns were being confiscated, even though he didn't authorize it.
Here's the issue on the guns that you seem to be stuck on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that illegal aliens, DUIs, death by DUI from American, is almost equal to the deaths by handguns? So if we secured the national border, the guard with the border with the National Guard, and prevent this Mexican invasion, we'd be saving almost, five to 10,000 lives. I don't see you saying put the National Guard on the border.
No, I didn't.
Who speaks for the people and the families of the death of DUI by illegal alien? Who speaks for them?
Well, I'm guessing
not you.
The people.
You're not speaking for them.
I'm guessing that they will sue the insurance companies and you know whoever owns the car. But Doug, isn't illegal immigration a whole separate thing from the gun thing, or is this about that those illegal immigrants are brown people?
No, you're switching the story again. You're saying that guns. You're talking about guns.
Okay, and you're very concerned about drunken brown people.
Handgun deaths in 2006 was 7,836 by the FBI stats.
Right.
Almost 10,000, if you add the murder rate of the illegal alien and the deaths by DUIs, it's almost 10,000.
Okay.
Almost 10,000. So
now, given that there's about 50,000 DUIs annually in the United States, it's not inconceivable, although it does seem if there are really 10 or 11 million illegal aliens in this country and there's 330 million of the rest of us, it does seem like that number probably isn't accurate, that it might be But even if it were accurate, let's do something about that. Let's make those people citizens, get them good jobs, get them into a union, and, you know, so that they can be at work all day instead of drinking.
Well, this is your change in your policy. You didn't used to say this. You used to say that to secure the border. You didn't say secure the border.
No, I never said secure the border. What I said is put the rich white guys who are employing illegal aliens in jail, and people will stop coming to this country illegally. I said that when Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the laws. And I've been saying it ever since. I continue to say it.
You got 8,775 divided into almost 310 million people. That's less than 0.003% for gun deaths and firearm deaths combined.
Right.
This is not the real truth. This is where I like to get you under a polygraph test in your fellow seditious progressive Democrats. The true reason why you're against guns, because you know that that is our last stop against tyranny, the tyranny of democracy.
Okay, so let me get this straight. I just want to be sure that I understand you, Doug. And for the record, I'm not opposed to people owning guns unless they're violent people. And that said, you're suggesting that people who believe in gun control, who think that there should be gun, and I'll put myself in that category. I think that guns should be licensed just like cars are. I think users should be licensed just like driver's licenses. I think they should be insured. They should be required to be insured, liability insurance at the very least, so that, you know, had those kids at Sandy Hook, had they been mowed down by a drunk driver or even an intentionally homicidal driver, Geico would be paying out $1 million to each one of their families right now. Instead, their families got nothing because they were killed with a gun. That seems crazy to me. So gun owners should have liability insurance. And every gun should have its serial number tracked from the time that it is manufactured until the time it's destroyed, just like we do with cars with a VIN number. And I'm in favor of the assault weapons ban. I think that weapons of war should not be on our streets. Are you suggesting that we need to have those weapons of war, that we should not have the assault weapons ban, because someday you're going to need to use your assault weapons against our government, against your next door neighbor who happens to work for the police department or the FBI or the the fire department or something?
Well, if that neighbor in the police department, fire department, and FBI is an oath taker and promised to uphold the Constitution, I got nothing to worry about. But if it's some seditious progressive Democrat, then yeah, I'm going to need that assault weapon.
So you're willing.
You don't believe in the Constitution as it is written, intended, and ratified. That's the real issue.
So you believe, you genuinely believe, Doug, that the Constitution has built into it language or intent that if we don't like the way our government is going or if we think that our government is oppressing us, we should kill government employees.
Not kill them. We get to rebel, and Congress doesn't have to put down the rebellion.
Well,
Congress,
you just said you would use your gun against your neighbor if he was seditious.
Against the government.
Okay, but the government is made up of people.
The government is made up of people, correct? But if the people come out, look what's happening now.
If you're not going to take your gun and shoot up a government building. You're gonna, you know, that's going to do nothing. You're talking about killing human beings here. Do you realize that?
I'm talking about defending our rights against a tyrannical government that no longer upholds the Constitution and the rule of law.
And you defend that right by give me a scenario. Just tell me how this is playing out in your head. One day. Obama sends the National Guard into your town and you go running out into the street with your AR-15 how do you see this playing out? I would love to hear this.
Well, that's a good question. You know, we haven't got that point yet because we don't have to, because little by little democracy has eroded on our republicanism of the Constitution till everybody's kind of, the majority of people are kind of settled into what's happening without, fighting back. So I don't know what it would take, but all I know is that I want to be able to defend myself, not with 5 rounds or 7 rounds. What up if the cartel decides to break into my house? I live on the border. Am I only supposed to have 7 rounds to defend myself? Hell no. I want 10,000, as many rounds as possible. Gun laws, gun control should be the same as it is for voting. Exactly. The same restrictions you put on voting that you want for voting, well, that means everybody gets to vote. Well, every citizen should be able to have their Second Amendment unfringed.
Okay. So why is it then?
Same restrictions on voting.
Well, that's an excellent point, Doug. And why is it then that the Republicans are so aggressively trying to limit people's right to vote when they don't want to limit even violent, crazy people's right to own a gun?
Now, see, there you go off on course. The Republicans don't want.
No, you brought up the topic.
Yeah, Republicans don't want to limit people's rights, citizens' rights to vote. Only non-citizens, dead people, and felons. That's it. Not citizens.
Okay.
It doesn't take much to get your
felons are felons are citizens.
No, I know wounded warriors that without legs that make it to the DMV to get a photo ID to vote. So don't tell me black Democrats, elderly Democrats, and poor Democrats can't make it to the DMV to vote.
Okay.
We're black Republicans, black Hispanic Republicans, women,
so
can all make
Doug,
it to the DMV to vote.
Okay, cool. So if they can all make it to the DMV to vote, why can't every gun owner make it to the DMV to register their gun?
Because the registry means that, like the British, it's where the government can find out who owns the guns and come confiscate them, just like what happened.
The British never confiscated the guns.
Just like in Hurricane Katrina, like you said.
Katrina.
It was the local police department. It wasn't the federal government.
Right, but they weren't working off any registry. They were just going door to door, knocking on the doors, saying, you got any guns?
Now, if you had to defend yourself against looters, wouldn't you want a gun?
I doubt it. Frankly, my guess is that if I had a gun, I'd be more likely to end up dead. And you get into a gunfight with somebody who's determined to take you or take something you've got. I think that's a far more dangerous route than simply saying, just go ahead and take it.
Well, you know, you could do what the bishop did in La Miserable, where, you know, the guy wants to steal your silver, you give him the candlesticks too.
Yeah,
I would
do that, frankly. I think my life is more valuable than anything I own, and other people's lives, even somebody who's stealing from me, I think are more valuable than anything I own. But apparently we have a difference of opinion on that, Doug. Doug, thanks a lot for the call. It's always good to hear from you. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Remarkable. Which raises an interesting question. If somebody was robbing you, would you say, go ahead and take it, rather than fight? Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. And let's check in for the news of the day with the Talk Radio News Service, Victoria Jones. Brought to you by the way, goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can get a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan. All of these made by women who saw somebody die in front of them. Victoria, and that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Victoria Jones. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up?
The Supreme Court ruled unanimously today for agribusiness giant Monsanto in the case of an Indiana farmer in what was dubbed by the farmer supporters a classic tale of David and Goliath.
Yeah.
They said that he could not take patented genetically modified soybeans and create new seeds without paying the company.
Now, what was his argument? Was it that you can't patent life forms and therefore this should be thrown out, or that he didn't know that Monsanto's soybeans were mixed in with the other soybeans in the from when he bought them from the grain elevator, and therefore if you don't know, you're not at, you know, what was his side of that argument?
It was patent exhaustion.
Oh, really?
Yes. Patent exhaustion. It was basically that he could do what he liked with products he'd obtained legally. And Justice Elena Kagan, who wrote the decision, said it didn't apply to the way he'd used the seeds. She said that under the patent exhaustion doctrine, he could resell them, he could consume the beans himself or feed them to his animals. But the exhaustion doctrine does not enable Vernon Bowman to make additional patented soybeans without Monsanto's permission, and that is precisely what Bowman did.
Right.
That allowing his tactic would destroy the value of Monsanto's patent.
Which takes us back to, I mean, if I buy a car, every piece in that car is patented. The car itself is patented. I could take the car apart. I can customize it. You know, they have those kits where you take the VW frames and turn them into something that looks like a Ferrari. I mean, you can do all that stuff without violating the patent because the patent has been exhausted, basically, by your having bought it. But the car can't, you know, hook up with another car and produce a third car. You know,
right.
it can't have an offspring.
The car, exactly.
And
now, they did say that this was a narrow ruling. They said our holding today is limited, addressing the situation before us rather than everyone involving a self-replicating product. We recognize that such inventions are becoming ever more prevalent, complex, and diverse. In another case, the article of self-replication might occur outside the purchaser's control, or it might be a necessary but incidental step in using the item for another purpose.
Hmm. So there's still not, nobody is challenging the idea of patenting life forms.
No. But, and some people are saying, well, even so, we can still take this ruling and apply it to cell lines, vaccines, software, and things like that. But they deliberately said in that Kagan ruling that this was a narrow ruling.
This is a one-off. Sort of like Bush v. Gore. It's a one-off.
That's what they said. But
yeah.
they had that other case fairly recently that also dealt with patenting of, I think it was cell lines, wasn't
yes.
it? Just in the last couple of
no,
months.
No, it was genes.
Genes.
Yeah.
Exactly. So they're going to have to address that in the next couple of months.
Yeah. Very interesting. Okay. So what
very
else is up?
President Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron held a joint press availability today after their meeting in the Oval Office. But it wasn't really a press conference because they only took one question each. Both men are a little embattled at the moment. I don't think either one of them really wanted to take a whole slew of questions.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama was asked in his multi-parted question about both the IRS and Benghazi.
Right.
And he came out swinging on the IRS, first of all, saying if you've got the IRS operating in anything less than a neutral, nonpartisan way, that's outrageous. It's contrary to our traditions. People have to be held accountable. It's got to be fixed. I've got no patience with it. I won't tolerate it. This is something I think people are properly concerned about. We'll make sure we find out exactly what happened on this. And he was clearly very, very angry. On the IRS.
I watched his response to the Benghazi one, and he basically called him out for playing politics and said that they were coming after Secretary Clinton and him and a few other people.
He did. And he also called them out on the talking points. He also not only called them out on the talking points, but he called them out on the timeline, which was very interesting, because what he basically said was that he called them out on a couple of things. He said that these emails that are being talked about at the moment, he said the congressional Republicans were briefed on these months ago, and they were. It turns out they were briefed in March. Mm-hmm. At least 19 senior Republicans, the ones who are making a fuss now, were briefed in March on these emails that they're screaming about right now. They were also, it turns out, we found out this afternoon, shown the 12 versions of the talking points at that time.
Wow. Now, I have a conspiracy theory, Victoria. My conspiracy theory is that John Boehner, you know, they just passed this we won't blow up the government with the debt ceiling thing if the president will cut a whole bunch of stuff, which he won't do, and it won't get through the Senate. So they're going to have to come up with some more moderate legislation to raise the debt ceiling. And and they're going to have to get it through the House of Representatives, which is controlled by the Republicans and influenced heavily by the Tea Party. So my conspiracy theory is that Boehner and the president's kind of going along with this dance, is allowing this churn to happen, this whole Benghazi dance to happen, so that, you know, the base is fed. And in the background, kind of quietly on a Friday night, they can pass out of the House a piece of legislation that raises the debt ceiling and doesn't crash our economy and, you know, send it along to the Senate and the president. What do you think? Do you think I'm crazy?
I think it's a very interesting idea.
Yeah. Okay. Well, ponder that one. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
I'm going to ponder that one.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting idea.
Because that would make sense why the Democrats also wouldn't be coming down like a ton of bricks on the Republicans right now, because they want, you know, the right-wing base to be fed. Anyhow, Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. On April 14th, 1789, George Washington was literally outstanding in his field. He was walking through the fields of Mount Vernon, his Virginia home, outstanding in his field. Ba-dum-bum-bum. I know, I love that joke. When Charles Thompson, who was the Secretary of the Continental Congress, rode up on a horse to deliver to George Washington a letter telling him that he had been elected President of the United States by the newly created United States Senate. This was great news for George Washington. He later wrote in a letter to a friend that I don't think he ever intended to go public, that he was glad he had been given the job because he was tight on cash, and it came with a paycheck. He was also honored to serve his country, as he had done as the preeminent general during the Revolutionary War. But this honor created two problems for him, that 30 days from then he had to be in New York City to be sworn in. The first was that he had to say goodbye to his ailing mother before setting off for that inauguration. She died before he was able to return from the inauguration. He did, by the way, go and say goodbye to her. The second problem Washington faced was trying to find a suit of clothes he could wear for the swearing-in ceremony, a suit of clothes that were made in the United States of America. When Washington became president in 1789, the majority of America's industrial and personal products were not made here. They were made in England. Full Employment Act. Yes, keep those British working. One of the ways that England kept the American colonies under their thumb and kept their own economy humming was by outlawing American manufacturing of most high-quality goods, including fine clothing. Instead, in the years prior to the Revolution, the British East India Company, the world's largest transnational corporation, controlled the production and transportation of a whole bunch of different things, which included fine clothing. So while cotton and wool could be grown and sheared in the United States, those raw materials by law had to be sent to England to be made into clothing. So George Washington called up, well, he didn't have a phone. I mean, he got in touch with his trusted friend and former Revolutionary War General Henry Knox and said, General Knox or Henry, I need a 100% made in America suit to take the oath of office. Now, at that time, there was only one man in the entire United States who had been defying Britain and bootlegging fine men's garments. He lived in Hartford, Connecticut. His name was Daniel Hinsdale. And General Knox rode his horse from Mount Vernon, Virginia, to Hartford, Connecticut, with the measurements of the general, because Hinsdale was publicly, now, legally, making high-quality all-American suits and dresses. Washington got it. He understood. The manufacturing had to be at the core of our economy if we were to prosper, which is why he went to so much trouble to make sure that he was wearing an American-made suit for his swearing-in. Thus, new President Washington asked his Treasury Secretary to look into ways to boost American manufacturing. So 2 years later, in 1791, this is the second year, arguably, of his Washington administration, his Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, presented his 11-point plan to build American manufacturing to Congress. By 1793, most of Hamilton's points had been made into law by Congress or turned into policy by either President Washington of the states. Hamilton's proposals, which included tariffs on imported goods and subsidies, government subsidies, federal government, I'm hearing conservatives' heads exploding all over America as they're listening. Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury, proposed that we should identify, that the federal government should identify specific industries that needed to be jump-started and subsidize those industries. And George Washington agreed, and we did. And that laid the groundwork for making America the greatest industrial powerhouse the world had ever seen. In fact, 100 years later, more than 100 years later, Abe Lincoln was, well, actually it was less than 100 years later, three or four generations later, but in the 1860s, Abe Lincoln was still doing this, subsidizing the railroads. For more than 200 years, we led the world in manufacturing. Being able to walk into a store, a big store or a small store, it doesn't matter, and buy something that has a label that said Made in America, it wasn't just some fantasy. This is the country that I grew up in. This is how it was in the United States until the Reagan years. Until the late, you know, by the late 80s, it was all starting to change and changing big. And then it got even, and then, you know, after Reagan, as we went into the Clinton years, it got even worse. I mean, we signed onto a series of so-called free trade agreements like NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, and signed the GATT agreements that created the WTO, the World Trade Organization. The result of these so-called free trade deals was that fewer and fewer American-made goods filled our stores. In just the, 13 years now since the Supreme Court put George W. Bush into the White House, we've lost over 60,000 factories in America. While Mitt Romney was running for president, his company, Bain, was dismantling a factory in Illinois and shipping it over to China. And to compound this insanity, right now the Obama administration is in secret talks to draft a Trans-Pacific Partnership, another so-called free trade deal that will further damage manufacturing and jobs in America. But where the United States is failing at keeping jobs and manufacturing ashore, other countries are doing just fine. Thank you very much. Last week, the European, and this is the news, last week, the European Commission of the European Union agreed to impose punitive import duties, tariffs, taxes on solar panels from China, a move they made to protect the EU from dumping of cheap Chinese solar panels in Europe. The duties on the solar panels will kick in by June 6th, and odds are people in Europe are going to find that European-made solar panels, they make a lot of them in Spain, actually, and Germany, that they're going to be, you know, cheaper than the Chinese. After the move was announced, the Chinese ambassador to the World Trade Organization immediately denounced it. He says, "It was a mistake. It will send." Well, here's his exact words. "It will send the wrong message to the world that protectionism is coming," end quote. Okay, so I asked the question, what's wrong with bringing back protectionism? The Chinese are practicing protectionism. You can't sell an American car in China without paying a 22% import tax. What's wrong with protecting jobs and manufacturing domestically? I mean, right now, everybody in Washington is hysterical over the budget deficit. But the fact of the matter is that the budget deficit is nowhere near as big or as dangerous to America as is our trade deficit. I mean, for decades, our trade deficit has been just under $1 trillion a year. Just so far this year, as of March, it's $38.8 billion. And because we're not protecting our economy, and other countries are with both tariffs and VAT taxes that they can reverse on export, it's nearly impossible to find and buy American-made goods in U.S. stores. It's been 200-plus years since George Washington went out of his way to find and wear an American-made suit for his inauguration. Since Alexander Hamilton told us how to become an economically strong nation. It worked. We led the world for two centuries. But in the 33 years since Reagan took power, we've gone from being... from manufacturing being over a third of our economy to it being about a tenth, we're back where we were. When the British East India Company was running the show. Bring back the tariffs.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's time to say we need a manufacturing revolution. We need a new trade policy. And we need to bail out of these so-called trade agreements. They're nuts. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Steve in River Forest, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was reading the other day the Kyoto Protocol said that we'd have to plant enough trees to cover the state of Texas in order to absorb our annual carbon output. And if that's true, even if it's half of that is true, we need to really get going. I mean, everybody that's listening here who gives a crap anymore should get out and start planting some trees.
Or dialing back our carbon output. I mean, that's the alternative.
Yes, yes, of course, all of the above.
Yeah.
But you can go online and get a sequoia, and it'll grow in most places in the United States. And
it really?
Cost about $6. Yeah, yeah. There's a website I found that showed pictures from all over the United States. People are growing these things, even in Florida.
Wow. Louise would love to know more about that. She's on this jag of, you know, what's the value of a tree, and, you know, we need to be planting trees. And I don't disagree with her. I'm concerned that it takes, you know, hundreds of years for trees to adequately sequester carbon. I think we need to do a lot more than that real fast. And
yeah,
and she agrees with me on that.
Too.
Pardon?
Bamboo is a good option, too, because it grows really fast. And, there's
true.
Species of bamboo that will grow in northern Illinois and some up in Michigan.
Oh, we used to have bamboo in our garden in Vermont. It was the hardest thing to get rid of. I mean, you can't stop it from growing. And, yeah, it grows like crazy. The only problem is that it only lives for one season, and then it dies, and all that carbon just gets released back into the atmosphere over the course of the next 2 or 3 years as the bamboo rots and decomposes.
Well, Louise can go to sequoiatrees.com if she wants to.
Sequoiatrees.com. Cool. I will tell her all about it. Steve, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you, and thanks for listening to WCPT. Katie, watching us on Free Speech TV on the Direct TV satellite system. Hey, Katie, what's up? In Hamul, California.
This is Katie in Hamul.
Uh-huh. Do you know Doug?
And I just, as I told your call screener, I just wanted to call from Hamul because I heard Doug again. I haven't been able to listen to you since you left the morning time on the West Coast, and I just was able to today, and there was Doug, and I do know where he lives, and I thought I'm going to get over my fear of calling, but I wanted to call you at least 1,000 times, or if I could be more hyperbolic than that, more, because we're a very politically active family here in East County and have been for about 100 years, and we're not all Dougs. Too many of us are, but, you know, we're working on it. So I just wanted to say that from Hamul.
Well, thank you.
And,
where exactly is Hamul?
It's well, if you know, if you get on the 94 freeway, it's about 20 miles east of San Diego, running right along by the border.
Oh, okay.
So the 94 freeway, and it seems to me that you had been in San Diego, or you knew something back when I was able to listen.
Oh, yeah. I used to be on the – we used to have a Clear Channel radio station that carried our show in San Diego.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I listened to it all the time.
KLSD, I think it was called.
Yeah, that's why I'm sort of grounded about the afternoon, because I don't have the kind of flexibility that I had then. But, sure, yeah, we went out and fought to save that and, you know, did everything we possibly could.
No.
But,
Romney's company was determined to, well, don't get me started. Anyway.
That was a Clear Channel station. I mean, I don't even know what they put in, but there was some very, very good faith, very, very sharp people who fought against that. I mean, the rest of us brought our bodies and our signs and we made our calls and everything, but it just, and San Diego has turned blue. Downtown is a blue city.
Huh.
And, you know, I mean, my folks who were born in 1910, 1913 grew up there, and I don't think they didn't know blue from red, because things were not so ugly. And as Doug, who's an angry, you know, right wing person.
Well, let's not personalize Doug. He's not here to defend himself. But San Diego is there's a Marine base.
To me, he's right here.
So, okay. Well,
of the many, many, many things I've wanted to call you about, one thing is that I spend, now that my husband and I are retired and he's Australian, I spend a lot of my time in Australia. And in fact, I'm a landed immigrant. And so I wanted to call about the medical care in Australia and some, you know, anecdotal stuff. And now that maybe I realize that I can talk on the radio and not have people point and laugh at me because only the dog's here, that I'd like to discuss that sometime. But
well,
I actually have a different kind of question, Tom.
Okay.
And it's kind of personal.
All right.
And in fact, members of my family have been involved in climate change at the PhD level for decades. And unfortunately, I feel my son is getting his PhD in the same kind of discouraging area in Australia. But so that was, you know, something else. But because we are so politically and environmentally aware on the human rights, and I believe, you know, in the climate area, I don't want my kids, who are about your kids' age or maybe a little bit younger, I just don't want them to have children. And today you said something that I said, what did you say, Tom? You said, knock on wood, with the grandchildren.
Yeah.
Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, I think that it's the natural human instinct to want to have your genes, you know, continue down through the generations. You know, we have three kids and none of them have kids, and I don't want to get into, you know, stuff about our kids, but Louise and I would both love to have at least one grandchild. And
feeling is, anybody I love, I don't want, and my mother was an early Rachel Carson person, and she told her daughters, I don't think this would be a good world to bring children into, and
I'm more of an optimist than that, Katie, and I know
that's where you and I disagree.
Yeah, and I know probably better than most people how bad things are and how bad they're going to get if we keep going down this road. But I, at the same time, I have seen, I mean, this country, this world, the human race, we have confronted mind-boggling challenges. I mean, just look at what our country has been through, you know, a civil war, World War I, World War II. I mean, we've been through, you know, we've been to hell and back. And I think that the resilience of human beings, I mean, the world is going to be a very different, if I had a grandchild or a great-grandchild, or great-great-grandchild, I mean, you know, wouldn't happen in my lifetime, but, you know, if there was somebody walking around thinking the way I did and experiencing the world the way I do, yeah, I think that, you know, it'll be a very different world, but I think that humans are still going to be around. But, you know, I'm not as fatalistic. frankly. I guess that's the only thing. So, Katie, I'm sorry we're out of time, but thank you for the call. Thanks for calling from Hamul. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's 28 minutes past the hour. Katie raises an interesting question. I mean, you know, is it a world to bring kids into? The good, the bad, and the very, very stylistically ugly. The good. Adam Smith, the Washington congressman, brought a full dose of sanity into the Fox News studio yesterday during an appearance on Chris Wallace's Fox News Sunday program. During a discussion about last week's Benghazi hearings, Smith criticized Wallace's portrayal of the president's reaction to the September attacks in Libya and questioned the motivations of congressional Republicans.
The way you just presented that was that by the Sunday afterwards that the administration said, here's what happens, here's our conclusion. I mean, look, the day after the attack, the president called it a terrorist attack. There was a dispute about how soon to leap to specific conclusions that now is being made into Watergate, into Iran-Contra. I think the desire of the Republicans to create a scandal here has really undermined any ability to have a credible look at what actually happened.
Well said, Congressman. This Republican obsession with the Benghazi cover-up has nothing to do with the truth and everything to do with smearing Hillary Clinton before the 2016 election. And no one needs to hear that more than the Fox News viewers. The bad. North Carolina Republicans. North Carolina has taken a sharp turn to the right over the past few months as Republicans in its state legislature have used their newfound majority to push through a host of extreme conservative laws. Now state Republicans are trying to stop the sale of Tesla electric cars in their state. Seriously. Earlier this month, GOP lawmakers in the North Carolina State Senate introduced a bill that would prohibit Tesla from selling its automobiles directly to Tar Heel state residents. Approved by the Senate Commerce Committee on Saturday, the bill requires Tesla to sell its award-winning electric cars through licensed dealerships only. This would cut into Tesla's direct delivery practice, business practice, to make it harder and more expensive for North Carolinians to buy environmentally friendly cars. Naturally, the state's Automobile Dealers Association is loudly supporting the bill. Screw over the environment to protect big business cronies. Sounds like a great plan, guys, and very Republican. And the very, very ugly Jim Inhofe. What is it about talking about Benghazi that brings out the worst in Republicans? During an interview on the Rusty Humphries Show last Thursday, the Oklahoma senator weighed in on former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's demeanor during the initial Benghazi hearings in January.
And I think that she has gotten by with that type of a forceful attitude. It's something that's not normally accustomed, that you don't hear from women as much as you do men. And she came out so forcefully.
Just completely sexist and very, very ugly. That is pretty amazing, you know, when you think about it. Richard in Evanston, Illinois, listening to WCPT. What's up, Richard?
Hello.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Good. I do.
Oh, wait, speaker. Good. You know, I guess there were two things that I don't understand about the gun arguments. I'm so sick of talking about them, but this idea of the armed revolution and the other, that guns don't kill. And clearly guns kill or the army wouldn't buy them.
Right.
Yeah, although the bullets are the thing that do the killing. So I don't understand that it's such a canard to kind of throw us off that maybe guns that have high capacities could really kill a lot of people. And the idea that people are the problem is really not something you can't solve. I mean, there's 300 million people.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't understand that argument. And I don't understand if they're mad about government and why they're not mad, for instance, when people do what you just were talking about and get rid of the opposition positions in the House or the buying of our government by corporations, and this doesn't get these same people mad. It's kind of weird, but I just don't. The anger that you didn't want to mention before is also so overwhelming that these are the people that shouldn't have guns.
Yeah, but you tell them that, and boy, that's gonna that.
Well, I mean, but we all run from them. You know, I mean, it's just weird. I mean, they for instance, guns don't kill. I mean. my goodness, they do. You can drop a gun, they can go off. And when Ruger fixed a problem many years ago, the gun community got very mad at Ruger. They made they had something that a guy dropped a gun, killed his kid, kept the gun, which is how nuts they are. Now, that's not all of them, but they do kill.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, I guess this is much of a point. You really advanced very far from when I first wanted to get on. But I don't understand also where the examples are in the civilized world where the restriction of ownership, like in Australia and in England, even in Italy, which makes guns, are kind of restrictive. You can have a gun, but you can have it at home, but if you use it at a shooting range, you have to go directly to the shooting range. If you go somewhere else and you get caught, you can be in trouble. So there's all these places that are not exactly what you would call, some sort of dictatorship.
Yeah.
It's just and how do you get?
I think what's going on, Richard, is you've got gun manufacturers who want to make a pile of money, and you've got right-wing racists who read the Turner Diaries and are all incensed about people of color and Jews and Catholics in many cases. And one of the most famous people who read the Turner Diaries and literally tried to act it out was Tim McVeigh. And because the Turner Diary opens, Turner Diaries, that novel, which is the kind of Bible of the hard right militia groups, opens with a white Protestant Christian, former GI, blowing up the federal building in Oklahoma City. And that causes the government to overreact and say that they're going to take away everybody's guns across the country, which causes all the good white Christian, militia guys to come out in the streets and start killing anybody who has a uniform and anybody who is any pigmentation to their skin of consequence. And, ultimately at the end of the book, the last man standing, the last people standing are the good white Christian Protestants. Yeah, because the race war and the anti-government war are over, and the government's gone, and then they can start rebuilding this country in the model that as a Christian nation. And I think you've got that group, those people who are living out that fantasy, which is, I realize it sounds kind of bizarre, but it's no less or more bizarre than reading Atlas Shrugged and becoming a Paul Ryan Republican libertarian. Atlas Shrugged is another one of these kind of books about, how we're going to change the world and make everything perfect. And then you've got, tragically, the cynics like Rand Paul, who's, pumping out this fundraising letter saying that Obama wants the United States to ratify the UN Convention on Small Weapons, which is designed to, for the first time, have some international regulation and oversight over the sale of things like AK-47s into war-torn areas to stop, this international trade in weapons, saying that this is part of Obama's plan to take away your gun, and it's got nothing to do with that, And I think when you mix those three things together, the political opportunism is a big piece of it, the paranoid racism is a big piece of it. And you mix it all together, and what you get is what we're hearing right now. And I think it's a very unfortunate and dangerous thing for our republic. Richard, I got to move along, but thanks for the call. Carol in St. Paul, Minnesota, listening on AM 950, Minnesota's Progressive Voice. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, the gun thing, I'm agreeing with you, but on the whole climate change, I get very, very frustrated in listening to people or talking to people. And so I came up with a question. And my question is pretty simple. I say, okay, let's suppose we become energy efficient. Let's suppose we go and we get green energy and we start using the right kind of light bulbs and we do those kinds of things. And the climate change people are wrong. What kind of damage have we done to the country by becoming energy efficient? And conversely, if we do nothing and the climate deniers are wrong, where do we end up?
Dead. Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely agree with you, Carol, and I think it's an excellent point. Thanks for calling and making it. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve, you want to talk about Benghazi?
Yeah, just real quick. The thing I don't understand is
you know, the way that the White House is defending themselves on an hour-to-hour, you know, day-by-day basis on this thing, I don't understand why he doesn't take a high road and just say, look, I welcome investigation. You guys take your time, do whatever, and when you have results, we'll talk about it.
That's what he said this morning.
I wrote there.
You know, they the administration did an investigation. They brought in, you know, generals and former CIA directors and a whole bunch of, you know, I don't have all the names in front of me, but I'm sure we'd both be impressed by them. And, you know, they did a thorough internal investigation and they passed it out to everybody. It's public. It's publicly available, and said, here's what's going on. They gave the whole 12 talking points back in March to all, you know, the Republican congressmen. Gave them to them, gave them access to all of these emails and documents that these guys just seem to have discovered last Friday. They've had them since March. You know, basically, they've been completely transparent about this from the get-go. And but, you know, Fox News is like, you know, really, really determined to gin something up, but, you know, probably for the ratings, I don't know. And you've got Republicans who are looking to... On the one hand, I think you've got Republicans who are looking to bloody up Hillary Clinton because, you know, they want to make her look bad, and you throw enough stuff against the wall and someone will stick, whether it's real or not. And secondly, I think that John Boehner is looking for a distraction from the upcoming budget fight over the debt ceiling. Stevie, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
See, anybody who says Benghazi, you know that person's been watching Fox News. It's like, nobody, ABC did one story on this, but this is a non-story. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and Laura. In Chicago, listening on WCPT.
Hey,
what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great.
I'm really, really bummed that we passed that milestone on the carbon dioxide in Hawaii, and I wanted to tell everybody, you know, we've been fighting fracking here in Illinois, and it's coming down to the end of the wire. We've got 3 weeks left to push a moratorium on fracking, an investigative task force, over a really weak and insufficient regulatory bill.
Mm-hmm.
And people need to know that fracking releases a lot of methane, and the University of Colorado and NOAA did a study, and they found that some of the wells are leaking 4 to 9%. So there's all these hundreds of thousands of wells, right? And they're leaking methane, and to break even, the wells would only be able to leak around 2.7% to break even with coal. So to be as
in terms of by break even, you mean to be as dirty as in terms of CO2 release into the atmosphere?
Right, because methane is far more potent a greenhouse gas than CO2.
Right, 24 times.
So a little methane equals, you know, a lot more CO2.
Lot, right, yeah.
So
for at least a couple decades.
Right, exactly. For up to 100 years, actually, it gets converted to CO2 slowly over the course of about 100 years. But initially, it's up to 33 times more potent than CO2, methane is, if it's released into the atmosphere. So these University of Colorado, NOAA did the study. They're like, oh, man, these wells are really leaking a lot. And Professor Ingrafia from the Cornell Fracture Group is going over Pennsylvania now, and he's trying to measure, you know, large amounts of methane over the entire state.
Mm.
And he's going to come out with a report in Science magazine pretty soon, I think, to kind of try to address this issue, because, of course, the oil and natural gas companies are like, oh, that was those studies at University of Colorado, those were only a few wells, and that doesn't really matter. But it does matter. Fracking is considered the number two industry for greenhouse gases. And we really need to stop this fracking. Not only does it poison our water and sicken workers and bring up radioactive debris, but it also releases a very, very large degree of methane into the atmosphere, worsening our global climate crisis.
Hmm. Yeah.
So can I give out some websites for people to go
sure.
to in Illinois?
Go for it,
okay,
Laura.
Okay, great. Don'tFractureIllinois.net. And stop the frack attack on Illinois. And we're asking everybody to call the governor, the attorney general, the Illinois lawmakers, Speaker Madigan, Senate President Cullerton, and ask them for a moratorium and an investigative task force to study the science before they decide how to move forward here in Illinois.
Interesting.
And we appreciate
that. That's great. Laura, Shano tells me that you're the person that we're going to send a copy of the Tom Hartman Reader autographed by me, courtesy of stamps.com to today, if that's all right with you.
Excellent.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Great. And please give it, what's that website again?
Yeah, don'tfractureillinois.net and Stop the Frack Attack on Illinois on Facebook.
Okay, great. Okay. Laura, thank you very much. I'm going to put you on hold so that Danielle can get your information. She's on line 5, Danielle. And excellent. Good information. Rodney in Chicago Heights, also listening on CPT. Hey, Rodney, what's up?
Tom, you seditious old Democrat, you.
Yeah, aren't we all?
Doug's his own definition of it, that you were seditious because you didn't follow the Constitution the way that it was written. And
but I think I do.
Yeah, well, but not according to him. In fifth or sixth grade, and maybe in junior high, we were studying the Constitution. And at a young age, you know, I wasn't the brightest student, but the people, that's plural for a person, and it refers to the state. So, you know, so by his own definition, he's seditious.
Oh, so you're saying the right of the people to possess firearms or arms, however it's phrased, but it says people, not any person. Therefore, you're saying it's not an individual right.
It's referring to the people under the state.
Yeah.
And the first part of it is a well-regulated militia.
Right, being necessary to the security of a free state, not nation.
But, you know, when I hear people just spouting off like that, you know, I feel sorry for them because they're so misinformed and afraid. And when they go on like that, it just, I feel sorry for them to the point that it fills me with sorrow.
I get it. Rodney, I want to get a couple more calls in here. We're just coming up on the end of the show, but thank you for your call and thanks for your comments. Chase in Scapulpa, Oklahoma. We got a minute to the end of the show. It's yours, Chase. You wanted to take me to task?
Yeah, hey, Tom. I listen to you every once in a while. I'm a Republican, just to get a different side of the view. But you, when you started mentioning about gun control, talking about these different groups you put us in, I kind of found that offensive. I'm a collector. I use my guns for home defense. I love to go shooting and as for sport, and I also hunt. And to sit here and say that I'm a racist and we fall into these groups,
I'm not saying you are. I was not talking about gun owners. I was talking about the people who are asserting that they are going to someday have to participate in an armed revolution against the United States of America.
Oh, I hope to God that doesn't happen. But that's one of the main focuses of the Second Amendment.
No, it's not.
The Second Amendment was put in during a time of a revolutionary war where they were against their tyrannical government.
No, it was not. Chase, the Second Amendment was put in long after the Revolutionary War, after we even tried another form of government with the Articles of Confederation that didn't work. And it was to protect the government, not to protect against the government. And the government that we fought against was not our own government. It was the government of a foreign nation. So, you know, and check it out. The reason the Second Amendment was put in there in the southern states was to preserve their slave patrols. It's why James Madison, in the fourth iteration of it, George Mason and Patrick Henry's speeches at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, so the southern states could maintain their slave patrols and the northern states wanted to have no army during time of peace. And
for audio
tag your
video archives, go to tomhartman.com.